Hi, everybody. I'm Ian Barrett.
And I'm Erin Hayes.
And welcome to Business Beat on WICN. Erin, who do we have on the show today?
We have Peter Stanton, publisher of Worcester Business Journal.
Obviously, if the show's called Business Beat and you don't have Worcester Business Journal on, you really can't call yourself a show, can you?
True. No, you cannot.
I'm looking forward to this. Really important player in the business conversation here in Worcester and an obvious choice for a fantastic guest. So let's get to it.
Welcome, everybody, to Business Beat on WICN. I'm Ian Barrett, your host from Media Boss. I'm here with Erin Hayes from Media Boss and David Ginsburg from WICN. David, who did you bring to the show today?
We are very happy to welcome Peter Stanton from the Worcester Business Journal, who also is a board member of WICN. We appreciate all the service over the years. Your guidance has been invaluable.
Thank you. And, you know, it's been invaluable for an undetermined amount of time. I can't even tell you how long I've been on the board, other than it's been, you know, 25-plus years. So, yeah.
It's actually a golden seat in the
boardroom. If it was worth something, yeah.
So Worcester Business Journal has been around for quite some time, obviously. Worcester, with the energy happening and momentum happening in the city, how are you seeing that reflected in the news that you cover and in the growth of business in the city now compared to even a decade ago?
It's interesting. I think if you asked me who sent us press releases, sort of, which means that you're sort of a company capable of sort of, you know, having a system for getting your own news out, I would say that sort of the number one area would have been historically Westboro, the Route 9 corridor. Second, sort of the Worcester, maybe in the city, or maybe those two were tied. I would say in the last, you know, decade, you've just got a lot more activity going on in town, a lot more businesses who have sort of sharpened their brand and how they're sort of presenting themselves as members of the community. And so I think, you know, there's been an uptick in some kind of sophistication and engagement of the firms who are here with their chins up saying we're proud to be in Worcester, as opposed to sort of, you know, the opposite of, you know, maybe not claiming it. And historically, frankly, there are a lot of businesses, and they still are, who moved their headquarters out of Worcester and eastward into Westboro, Framingham, which is fine. Several have branch offices there. Many move there. You know, so I think that a lot of that out-migration, it's not that it has stopped because everyone has to do what they need to do to sort of maximize their business, but I think there's a lot more of a magnet to be part of this. There's a lot more focus now on being part of the city, and I think an importance in sort of having some real estate here.
We have 10 colleges in Worcester, and traditionally kids would graduate and move on and never come back. And now there's been a big push to keep the kids here and start businesses, incubators, including a space in this building. What kind of impact is that having on business growth here with the young entrepreneurs?
There's no question. If you look at Boston's ecosystem, well, it's hard to compare. But if you look at some of the cities with real ecosystems that support a startup community, it's critical to have a lot of the smaller sort of incubator spaces that help catalyze that. I also think that there's other elements of that culture, which is, you know, venture capital firms around and a lot of people watching investors. Clearly, MIT has been probably the greatest engine for entrepreneurial growth. I mean, not Harvard and not the other schools in Boston, but sort of the whole, having that whole industry of innovators and investors all there. I think Worcester is starting to have some critical mass on the incubation side, and I think we're supporting that. It's still not, if we measured percentage of the economy, it's still a very small percentage, but I think we're making progress, and one of the next levels is sort of how does a company who wants to put its roots down here and grow, can they do second and third stage growth while not being in Cambridge, right? Sort of how wide is the envelope at which investors, if they're on that kind of track to try and grow rapidly? So I think that's it's a small amount, but it's really good to see it there. It has a lot to do with the vitality.
Well, to advocate for this community, for Worcester as a whole, is with the example of Cambridge, for instance, MIT. You know, I've watched that grow up. There was just empty fields, really just across the street from MIT for a long time. So 20 years ago, wide open swaths of land. Every single inch of that space is now completely occupied with buildings, with incubators, with startup businesses, with new tech companies, but the space comes at a premium. So I go and visit these incubators, I go see these startup companies, and they're basically in a trailer paying a ridiculous amount of money and trying to, you know, fit two people to an office just so they can say they're from Cambridge. At the end of the day, you need some space to get your work done, and I think Worcester has an amazing population. You've got some excellent schooling here. You've got a place to open up your footprint and actually get around.
And you have a support system. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce is excellent here, and I think that's another big bonus.
I agree. You know, if only, so had you thought about investing in Kendall Square 20 years ago, if only you bought an acre?
That's a great point. Nobody would have thought of that. No, I mean, honestly, it would have been amazing to do that. And, you know, all the spaces are gone. Think about investing in Charlestown in 1970, right?
Yeah.
That was nothing. And now look at the gentrification that's there. So there's no places to invest in Boston anymore.
MBI is the Mass Biotech Initiative, and they have, you know, offices here in Worcester, and Kevin O'Sullivan ran that for a long time, and they have a great story. You know, it was 35, 40 years ago that, you know, some business leaders got together and said, without understanding the science, they said, we've got to get into this sector. And I think we've grown some companies here, UMass Medical as an engine of research. You know, you can hear Michael Collins speak, and he's got his rap down. They have done a spectacular job of sort of attracting outside capital, you know, grants from NIH, et cetera, to sort of build that kind of engine. So I think in some industries like that, we're out of a general entrepreneurial kind of startup community. I think we're a little bit remain behind. But in that kind of biotech sector, I think we've done some smart work. And in the end, the space is a real issue. And you're absolutely correct. The price of things in Worcester, we can complain about the taxes, but the price of, you know, the square footage price in central Mass, Worcester and surrounding towns, is such a fraction of what it is in Greater Boston. And some firms, it is important to have that shingle in Kendall Square, but sometimes you can have other extended operations in a much lower cost area in the state with still with a lot of access, and then sort of layer on top of that, what does it cost my employees to find a place to live? And, you know, Greater Boston is choking in traffic, which is a quality of life issue. But I grew up in Newton. It's insane what the price of housing is in a lot of those suburban ring towns. So I think there's a lot of attractiveness, you know, and Worcester County has seen real growth, population growth. Some of that is people, the greater Boston suburban area, just sort of flowing out and living here. Other parts of it are sort of, you know, growth coming from companies.
You mentioned the cachet of having a shingle in Cambridge, but the truth of the matter is being here in Worcester means you're close to really important rail, you're close to major highway, and you're 20 minutes out of the traffic jams for any shipping that you're doing on the Northeast Corridor. And I mean, it depends on what kind of company you're going to be. If I'm in a business where I'm manufacturing and shipping, why would I be anywhere but here? This makes a ton of sense. You can have like a WeWork office in Boston for an address and, you know, do all the business out of here, you know?
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
You know, I'm curious, because we're downtown and we see literally day to day the changes taking place down here. How much is Worcester's investment in its core? Because for a long time, downtown was not a destination. It was a place to be avoided. And now that it's become a destination again with restaurants and hotels, and the restaurant scene is exploded in Worcester, as you know. How much of an impact on Central Mass as a whole has the rejuvenation of Worcester's downtown been kind of a driving factor?
So I think when you look at, if we 50 years ago drew the rings around Worcester and said, where do I go for stuff, shopping, entertainment and all that stuff, is Worcester my city of choice? And what happened really from, you know, 50 years ago up until, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago was that that iceberg was melting, and Worcester was the center, the central city for fewer and fewer and fewer surrounding towns. That has turned, and it's turned, I would say, if we pick sort of a catalyst, I'd say the Hanover Theater was a big difference maker there, because you're looking at high-quality theater, and when you go for high-quality theater or entertainment, you're saying, okay, I'm into Boston, I'm parking for $35, I've got this kind of traffic to it. You sort of run your list of, and I'm going to eat at a restaurant for how much, and then you run those parallel numbers. And I think the theater has done a great job. Maybe we're not getting people coming out of Boston to the Hanover Theater. That's fine. But if you look at that ring of 30 to 40 miles surrounding Worcester, they've really created that consciousness. I really, before then, it was the DCU Center, frankly, that was a venue with unique acts, and you know, still there are certainly shows coming there, but I would say that the Hanover does that, and certainly Mechanics Hall. You know, we've got a couple of really world-class or national-class/world-class venues.
Mechanics Hall, without question, is world-class. It's known for around the world because of its acoustics. It's a really amazing building. And as a matter of fact, Bose still does work there every year to test their speakers and technology at Mechanics Hall because it's so iconic for sound.
Yeah, and Yo-Yo Ma has, you know, done several recordings there, just, you know, with nobody in the building.
No one's allowed in.
Just doing some of his own stuff,
No jackhammers outside.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we have to talk about the Woo Sox. We have to talk about what baseball is going to do to the center of the city. We were in, was it North Carolina? Was it,
North Carolina.
North Carolina recently, and they have a stadium right in the center of the city, and that is amazing for what it's done, because it's not just your regional team or your affiliate team, but it's all the events that happen, your high schools, your events, your concerts, college games. It becomes a really important reason to get people back in on a regular basis. What do you think it's going to do?
It's interesting. If you look at sort of the neighboring, it is going to be sited on a large parcel of land that has been owned by Wyman Gordon Company that has not been used for manufacturing for 25 years. So it's really sort of a vast empty site. And most of the other additional $150 million worth of add-on development is also supposed to take place in these open parcels that might have been similar to Kendall Square that we talked about earlier. The Canal District, which is right next to it, really has had its own organic momentum that's been building for the last 10 years. So I think the stadium, I think if we expected, if we had a dead downtown or a dead district and said, oh, this stadium is going to save us, I think that would be misplaced. Mm-hmm. If it's another big additional center of activity next to a really organically grown, neat district that just has got this new investment of a $22 million building from Alan Fletcher, you know, the Marketplace building with Watrous Brewery. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And this stuff is going on now. And that building, if it isn't open, it's opening next week. So I think the ballpark is just one more really big investment in activity. And I think the other important part of the ballpark investment is that it catalyzed that, you know, hotel development, retail development, maybe an additional residential. So, you know, that remains to sort of be shovels in the ground there. There's a baseball team in town that's sort of a college league team. Yeah. They do great. I think Worcester, if there was a single A team, you know, available, we might have gone after that, you know, Red Sox affiliate. Son of a gun if it wasn't the Triple A team that's, you know, the last place you go before joining the Red Sox in Fenway Park. So it was a real coup.
It's an absolute coup.
A lot of money invested in making it happen.
Worth every penny.
And one of the great things for the city is finally Kelly Square is going to be configured in a way that's not a death race every time you try and make your way through.
Yeah, although won't you kind of miss it? There's a certain...
I learned to drive going through there, so I'm okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to miss the just floor and hope for the best, but for newcomers coming into the city, it is a major gateway into downtown Worcester. You need to have a traffic setup that isn't so confounding and, oh my, terror, white knuckle terror, oh my God, what do I do now?
Yeah, what you do is you just keep nudging ahead and work your way into the stream. But you're right. There isn't a sign explaining all that.
They don't have that sign, so you just nudge carefully and then slam it.
Well, that's how you keep the locals out. You keep the locals in and keep the outsiders out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think, well, you know, I agree with, you make a great point, because a lot of people around the country, the stadium, if you build it, it will come, stadium concept has been going on with these NFL teams for a long time, and every single one of them has been a boondoggle. Sure. But you did mention that you had the other components. You do have hotels here. You have a high-density population. You do have other service industry here. You do have restaurants. You do have the parking. Yeah. These are all really critical things. Yeah. And what I think is unfortunate for Pawtucket, which is they didn't realize what they had, and they didn't develop the product, and you're down at the end there when you go down to the stadium, and it didn't grow the way it should have. Having the team should have been a bigger deal for them.
Pawtucket, I don't know that Pawtucket can be faulted. I think that two additional factors in that $100 million deal. One is the team is paying $1 million in rent with a 30-year lease. So that, you know, cuts into that number. And we had, I believe it's $32 million in a state grant supporting infrastructure, redesign of Kelly Square, you know, siting of a new garage of 350 or 400 spaces. So investments in that project that help make the whole thing come together. And the state of Rhode Island had been burned.
Yeah. Thank you, Kurt Schilling. Ironically, a former Red Sox player.
What that has to do with the Paw Sox is really absolutely nothing. But it got kind of drawn together as, you know,
once
subsidy
bit,
of
once
baseball.
Once bitten, twice shy. People, they didn't want to see any money going to anybody after that had happened, because it was a very poor thought out deal with his studios to begin with, and nobody wanted to see it. And they're a small state. They can't afford that. Yeah. They can't. They ate that entire deal. Yeah.
And what's crazy is, you know, they had a president of the team before Larry Keno took over, was this guy named Skeffington, who was a lawyer and with a lot of political connections. They were trying to land it in downtown Providence. And you're going to the state effectively saying, please heavily subsidize moving this team 6 miles down the road and favoring one municipality significantly over another. We never quite got down to reading about the three Massachusetts municipalities and whether the state was evenly kind of, you know, was that $32 million? Would it have gone to Weymouth if it was going there? Hard to say. That never really got on the table. But in Rhode Island, it was like, wow, how do we really kick Pawtucket in the teeth, you know, and move it into Providence? So I think the politics around that were difficult too. But anyways, it's a great opportunity for Worcester. It brings a level of activity. You know, that's a stadium. It's an urban design stadium is a completely different thing than the suburban one. And Worcester has the right to do, I think it's like 10 events a year. So I would imagine 4th of July celebration, there'll be lots
and
of stuff.
Concerts there and that kind of stuff.
There will be a lot. That will be much more than baseball.
The Fenway model, you're seeing people who know how to do it. When remember the first concert at Fenway, people were like, what are you doing? Yeah. And well, we're like, I got to pay for this place. Where do you think these stands and the bleachers come from? How does this get built, you know? I think what they did right with Fenway, which is said, we need to keep this footprint. New York built a brand new stadium, spent all this money, charged ridiculous seasonal fees for the seats. You watch any Yankees game right now in that new stadium, and right behind home plate, empty.
Yeah, every game.
You go to every game at Fenway,
it's incredible. Yeah.
And it's going on because you've got nightclubs there, you've got restaurants there, people are parked. They don't want to leave. They want to get there early. There's a whole social atmosphere around that.
Yeah.
That's the difference between the way Fenway does it and the way they do it in New York.
It's a destination instead of just a destination.
And so a lot of those places in the Canal District that are cool to go to before the game or after are really right there within easy walking distance from that stadium. And I'm very, very optimistic that the architect who is designing this did the expansion for Fenway. Yeah. I believe she was also involved
in the Baltimore
Stadium, which is a spectacular kind of the way that fits into the urban space. So anyways, the consciousness around that. Worcester's, you know, had many projects where we didn't, you know, put the right sufficient parameters on developments. And then you end up with kind of suburban concepts shoved into...
Which was the old Galleria.
Oh, the old Galleria is, you know, of all the things, you know, ultimately the rebirth, the wrecking ball that, you know, hit that thing was also, that's the negative side of it. By tearing something down, it accelerated the rebirth of the city. But I think that really did.
Do you think that with, I know you're not in the prediction business, but if you can forecast a little bit with the rejuvenation of downtown, especially to your point about knocking down the Galleria and the rebirth that caused, getting things right in terms of zoning and planning for the Polar Park and the Worcester Red Sox coming, that there's some institutional know-how in the city now, in city government, in the Chamber of Commerce, so that as we look at the rest of the city, where there's still plenty of room for expansion and growth, I think of like the Mill Street Corridor, for example, that now that they have a template, in a sense, to work from, that's going to accelerate growth and development throughout the rest of the city.
I really hope so. And I think in the end, that's the scorecard we're looking at. Clearly, restaurants have gone in the downtown area and throughout the city. So that particular kind of boom, you know, is consistent. I think some people could get frustrated and say, geez, we're pouring all this money into downtown. Is that really the epicenter? And are things happening in the neighborhoods? I would say, having heard Ed Augustus speak and give his input on various new projects, I think the consciousness in the city with him and his team is much greater than it was, you know, 20 years ago about how do we make sure that that projects that are designed for urban space match urban space.
Right.
The other factor is that when you got almost no developers coming to you, there's no competition, right? And so if some building comes up and three or four people give you a proposal, that's a lot better than you get one and you didn't like it, or you didn't get any, and you try 5 years, you know, again for something. I mean, that Wyman Gordon site, I don't know if they were waiting for a proposal. That was empty for a long time.
Yeah, they talk about a sleeper hit. That was the Kendall Square thing we were talking about.
Yeah, I guess so.
But, you know, I think along Mill Street, two-lane road either side, you have an empty supermarket that's been there for, it's been empty for 15 years minimum, dead space just sitting there, and you could put a complex there. You could have a movie theater and restaurants and make it another nightlife destination for the neighborhoods, for West Tatnick and that side of the city.
When we talk about sort of the rebirth of a city, I was just in Detroit at...
Speaking of rebirth.
Yeah. So their population from 50 years ago was 2 million people. It went down to 700,000. You know, Worcester's floated up a little bit in that 170, 175, is it 189 now?
180, yeah.
Jeez, okay. You're on top of the numbers. So second biggest city in New England.
Check every day.
You know, and so ultimately urban space comes alive when housing density happens. And so if the downtown's really going to kind of hit that critical mass of activity, you know, we're right downtown. I know there are two really cool new coffee shops right off the common. We need more people living downtown to make sure that there's a third or a fourth, or that those get really well supported. The younger generation likes living in cities. Mm-hmm. The younger generation are often happy with zip cars, right, clearly in Boston, because you're paying crazy amounts for a parking, sure, space. But for urban life to happen, it has to be walkable. Mm-hmm. And I think the city's aware of that. There's investments in sidewalk infrastructure and making that look nicer. But all that aside, you've got to have people living in and around that area and really, you know, building that critical mass where you just sniff and you go, something's happening here. You know, right. Shrewsbury Street has kind of had that, even though it's just a corridor.
The life. I mean, yeah. It, for a long time, you know, after 6 o'clock, you're either at the Palladium or at a concert or you weren't anywhere. I mean, there was nothing else to do. Now the city has a 24-hour clock, and that's the beauty of it. And when Chop House first came in, it was like, wow, we've got a fancy restaurant on this road. Now look at that street. It's like, where don't you go, you know?
Right, and having Union Station done over and open again and beautiful.
Which
the
I think
downtown in Shrewsbury Street
is amazing. That, not only, that's iconic. Every city needs their Eiffel Tower. And I think that station is, without question, a focal point of this community. It's a beautiful place to look at from the highway.
So I was on the Union Station Alliance, which was a citizens group formed in the early 90s. The Telegram had run an article and some editorials that said, tear this old, you know, terrible thing down. And the replacement strategy was a 10,000 square foot glass bus station. So a bunch of us got together and said, geez, this thing's iconic. The towers weren't even on it at the time. They'd been taken down. So we worked and, you know, went back and forth, and WRA ultimately, which was sort of owned it, ended up getting federal transportation money. It had a, you know, $28 million restoration, and it wasn't really a catalyst for a lot of new activity in the immediate neighborhood, but it's an iconic message that says when you drive through with its lights on and the flags there, you go, wow, that's cool. The woman, a senior executive from the DC Hotel Group, who owns a couple of properties around here, said, I made a real mark in Worcester. When that thing got renovated, I said, I'm going to look closely at Worcester. That's a sign that the city's turning around.
That's a good point. Excellent point.
That's not looking at the leases and whether the thing is break-even and is there water leaks. It's like, what am I saying about
my city? We're not going to give up.
Yeah. As you drive by.
If you care about your history, you're going to go into the future. It's when you stop caring about the history that
things
go a little strange.
We've lost a couple churches lately. But
well, New York tore down one of their stations.
It was Penn Station, yeah.
Penn Station, yeah. It was Penn Station. What a horrible architectural loss. What a horrible transportation loss. It was
the engineering infrastructure of that facility was just beyond.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, that's when every time I would go by, I'm like, wow, you can't let this go. So you saved it. And now rail is important again. Yeah. Be able to the commuter rail is how people are going to come back and forth because they don't want the cars.
Right.
20 years ago, it was like, oh, everybody's going to have a car. We don't need these dumb train stations.
And of course, what Worcester is fighting for is not just a better schedule, maybe even doubling current service, right, where you really have a lot of choices, but also what's that schedule coming back out from the east, whether it's from Framingham or from Boston? You know, can we get folks commuting back in this direction for jobs in that downtown area?
And now we're seeing, you know, when they first reopened Union Station, it was kind of a standalone place, and now there's the new dorm behind it. There's new restaurants going into the building itself. You know, I've taken the train from there. Years ago, you couldn't get a cup of coffee at the train station. Now right. There's going to be restaurants, and it's a destination to go to. And you can walk across the street, and there's more restaurants, and you're in downtown, and all of a sudden, it's a place to be.
Yeah, and so you look at the renovation of the North High School, or the old trade school into housing, you just start clicking them off. There was a plan for the Boys Club that didn't quite happen, and I know they're still trying to work on some investor there, but you know, the auditorium has got someone studying at the old courthouse.
Those are great buildings, too.
Yeah. Those are great buildings,
yeah. The auditorium's a beautiful building.
The one when you look at Lincoln Square, the one that you'd love to, if you had the municipal money, that you would love to redo would be sort of the Soviet-style cement design of the police station. You'd like to sort of, why don't we turn this around and give them a total redo? It would be. I'm sure they would.
The brutalism concrete thing was hot for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, City Hall in Boston is probably the best example. It's brutalism. It's what it's actually called, and it's meant to be imposing city structure to say that we're here. But it is. I remember when I first came to Boston, the cab driver told me, he said, "You know who designed that building?" He said, the guy took a penny, turned it upside down, said, that's what I'm gonna make City Hall look like. So it's like the Lincoln Memorial upside down, made out of concrete. And it's even worse, more depressing on the inside than it is on the outside. So what's next? I mean, we've got a little bit of time left. Can you put your crystal ball out and tell us what you see beyond the baseball team?
So the baseball team comes. Ultimately, you want streets that are full of people, and you want buildings, empty buildings, that are full of offices or housing. And as David suggested, we need to have the measure of success extend beyond the downtown. Although the downtown is how people measure you, just like it's the station that you drive by on the highway. Those are sort of the easy metrics. You know, longer term, if you said, where is Worcester and what do we consider success? You know, success is taking the challenge of a very diverse population in the city and a school system that's doing its best, and how do we reinvest even more to bring that up to a higher level, right? So if you really looked and said, how do we really keep score? The schools are so directly related to the price of housing, right? And so I think that if you look more broadly and say, how do I bring the activity and investment that's downtown into several other key parts of the city? How do I support neighborhoods and other areas? You know, even Shrewsbury Street, which has had its boom, has more potential. You know, you've got this magic connection between UMass and downtown. How do we look there and not just, you know, do downtown stuff, but focus on leveraging whether it's Mill Street or, you know, those areas even further since they're already popular. So we do an event, a 40 under 40 event. If I took a score of all these younger folks and said, who's like thumbs up on Worcester, who's okay with Worcester, who's like indifferent to Worcester, I'll tell you, in the last 5 to 8 years, that has changed so dramatically. Wow. Not just for people in the city, but for those surrounding it, those coming to it, those coming here socially, going to stuff. We have this massive affordability advantage, although it's very interesting. We run a columnist who owns a bakery shop down in the Canal District, and she was bemoaning all the street work and the slowdown and the fact that there are investors coming from Boston, like outside of Worcester, buying up some of the buildings down there, and that's going to drive up rents. And you feel like some artist, you know, who like got into this hot district, and it's like, oh crap, they discovered like our mill building is now like worth a lot of money. And it's no longer affordable, you know, for us. And so I think we haven't had that problem in Worcester, and partly you go, oh damn. And then you look at it and go, that's what progress looks like. City has to have a strategy for how do I help these folks. I don't know what they ended up doing. The Midtown Mall has been you know, sort of this problematic space. And it's got a lot of very low-cost vendors there. And so the question is, if we're going to redo it and make it fancy and all that stuff and it'll get more expensive, we also ought to be helping those vendors find a new place to sell their stuff and reach their community, even if you're going to kind of change that up enough that they're not going to be able to afford it. So I think, you know, that's one of the keys is how do we help everybody succeed, not just sort of double down on making, you know, rents go from, you know, $18 a foot to 30. I think the city can be much more of a regional epicenter. I think that trend that shrunk can be increased. I think it remains we have a lot of potential. And, you know, cities be there, mid-sized cities can be great mid-sized cities.
I agree with you 100%. It's definitely exciting. I think that it's nice that you have the focus to say, you can't just do all one thing. It has to be holistic. It has to be the whole group. It has to be the whole area. And I think Worcester has put a lot of pieces together that made this wonderful development happen and makes it sustainable over the next 10 more years, because you can't just boom and bust. You know, you got to keep it going. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope this is not the last time you come on. Maybe we can have more focused topics around particular industries or particular businesses going forward, but super enlightening. And obviously, what's business be without you?
Well, we keep our finger on the pulse of business, and it's, you know, in Central Mass, you know, not just Worcester, Central Mass, and certainly Worcester's, it's a great place to be these days.
What a great guy. That was a great show.
I learned so much. You have no idea. I did not know anything about Worcester, apparently.
Well, I mean, for a guy who's as connected as he is, he really has seen it come up and down, and he's one of the believers that it's always been a wonderful place. I had no idea he was involved in saving the train station. What a wonderful asset for the community. Peter was a great guest. We obviously have to have him back on the show.
We definitely do. I mean, I learned a lot this show, and I can't wait to learn more next time we have him on.
Thanks for listening to Business Beat. I'm Ian Barrett.
And I'm Erin Hayes.
See you next week.